You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Filmtrepreneur Podcast, episode number 77. Once you choose hope, anything is possible. Christopher Reeve.
This is the Filmtrepreneur Podcast, where we teach you the top strategies, tactics, and growth hacks that every indie filmmaker needs to know to make money with their films. We are the podcast that puts the business back into show business. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Filmtrepreneur Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. Today on the show, we have the head honcho of the American film market, Jonathan Wolff. And Jonathan has been a guest on the show many times before, but this was an extra special interview because when COVID hit, I was really curious on how not only the Cannes film market, but the AFM is going to continue, because obviously a film market, a convention, if you will, traditionally needs to be in person. And I was wondering how Jonathan and the team over at AFM was going to be able to handle this new reality that we all live in, which is COVID-19. And they've come up with a really interesting way of moving forward with this, which is basically American Film Market Online, or AFM Online, where they're trying to emulate the exact same experience, or even better in some instances, experience you have at the AFM. And we talk deep about what they're doing, how they're doing it, if it's going to work, let's see. But I also really wanted to pick Jonathan's brain about what is going on in our business, what is going on the film distribution side of the business, where he sees things moving forward, because he has been in the film distribution space for decades now. And I was really interested to hear his thoughts about the theatrical experience, what's going to happen theatrically, where the studio's going, where independents are going, how they're going to be able to make money, how distributors in general are reacting about what's going on in the business, and so on. So this is a very lively and informative episode. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Jonathan Wolff. I'd like to welcome back to the show returning champion, Jonathan Wolff. How you doing, Jonathan?
Good to see you, Alex.
I'm good, man. I'm good. So anything happening? Have you heard anything? What's going on?
I'm just relaxing, you know, sitting in the backyard, having a margarita now and then, just, running out of chips.
That's the worst thing that's going on, is your chips are running out, right? Oh, God. It is. Well, since last we've spoken, the world has changed in a once in a generation kind of way, which we all know about, which is the COVID pandemic that is happening and ravaging not only the world, but our small little corner of the world, which is the film industry. And I know when it hit last year, I feel like it's last year, when it hit earlier this year.
It feels like more than a year.
I feel like we've been doing this forever, but talk about fatigue, Jesus. And I mean, I don't know how much more things could happen in 2020. I mean, I said that the mole people haven't risen up yet. Atlantis hasn't come out of the ocean. The aliens haven't landed yet. And the meteor technically hasn't hit yet. So there's still that.
Well, there's turmoil in Washington, the hottest year on record in the planet. You know, we'll We'll make the trifecta.
I mean, oh, there's so much. I mean, there's just so many things you can't even comprehend. But this has been a very trying year, not only for in our industry, for film filmmakers and film production, but film distribution has been thrown upside down. And of course, you running AFM have seen you basically have a front line, front row seat to what's going on, because you see what's happening. Yeah. Yeah, with all of your other vendors and companies and things like that. So before we even get started, just for people who don't know who you are, can you just give a little quick update on who you are, sir?
Sure. Jonathan Wolf, Managing Director of the American Film Market, which is run by the Independent Film and Television Alliance. And we're a trade group for motion picture and television distributors, basically the independence version of the Motion Picture Association, the MPA. We look after the interests globally of film and television companies that operate outside the studios, the independents. And of course, we have the American Film Market, which is usually an annual event in Santa Monica, not this year, but an annual event that is the bookend to Cannes, where the industry is in Cannes to do business in the spring. It comes to Santa Monica and in Hollywood's backyard, essentially, to do business in the fall. And that's where we sit. We watch what the industry's going. We try and serve them where we can, either with research or advocacy or creating a film market where they can do business efficiently.
So this thing called COVID, sir, how has it affected the AFM this year? Because normally I would be getting ready to take my Uber down.
How has it affected? Let's see. You said we only had 3 hours, right?
Exactly.
It's really been a sort of a double whammy, if you will. COVID has affected the film industry in terms of the ability to shoot, the problem with insurance, the problem of getting bonding, and all of this. And at the same time, it's affected the event industry. Hotels are closed. You can't go to sporting events. And, of course, you can't go to markets and trade shows. So now we find ourselves operating a business that's affected by COVID, trying to serve clients who are uniquely affected by COVID. Here in the auto industry, they're still making cars. They found a way to do that. But being on the set, the closeness of those who are working together, COVID has been devastating. And there are companies that are making it work, but it's challenging and expensive. So where we found ourselves serving, we have our own challenges in serving an industry that's facing its own challenges.
So AFM, like you said, normally we'd be going to Santa Monica. Like it's been since Chaplin. I don't know when it started.
It started in 81 and the market got moved to Santa Monica in 91. And right. So it's been 30 years.
So it's been a while that it's been going on. God, I could only imagine what AFM would have been like in 1981 or 82, 83. There must have been, oh my God.
In 81, I wasn't there, but in 81, they used what is now the W Hotel in Westwood.
Oh, wow. And
it was closed for what was back then a 9-day market. And so, industry evolves over what's almost half a century.
Jesus. So now obviously we're not going to the Lowe's this year, the hotel. So how are you bringing AFM to the marketplace? Because I know you were keenly watching Cannes when Cannes was going on, because Cannes got pretty much buzzsawed by this because they were first up. So they were the guinea pig of a major market having to deal with not having a major market, having to do a virtual version of it. And I've heard mixed reviews on the virtual on their end. So I want to know what you guys are doing and how do you see it playing out?
Well, first, we're really grateful that Cannes went first. We got to learn from what they did. We saw what they did that we liked. We saw what they did that we thought we might want to do different. And so, like I said, I'm grateful. And I would not have wanted to be in their shoes, because in addition to going first, they were actually facing a moving target. They didn't know if they would go in May. Then would they go in June? Then would June be on site or would it be digital? Then would if the festival wasn't happening, did the festival want a market to happen without a festival? So within their stakeholders and their governance, if you will, they were constantly facing a moving target that made it even more difficult. For us, we made the decision in the first week of July that we were going online. And so it gave us 4 months of planning, but it also gave the industry certainty. as to what they would be doing and where they would be doing it. Because part of the frustration that CAN probably suffered from was all of the stakeholders who were waiting to decide what it is they were supposed to do. Are they going to CAN? They're not going to CAN. What kind of, what's the date? There was so much going on that was moving. And not that we're in a stable place in any of us in this world, but at least being able to establish our dates and what we were doing 4 months out, let everybody, including us, plan a bit. So that's the good news. Of course, the bad news is we're now online, and we serve a diverse audience. We have production and distribution companies that are looking for territorial buyers. Of course, we have those buyers from all over the world. We have the production community, producers and writers who have packages that are looking to either connect with other creatives or connect with those who might be able to bring those films forward. We have production services who come in, film commissions, studio facilities, of course, the lawyers, the bankers, the agents. And so it's a diverse group. And when they come usually to Santa Monica, they're all doing different things. Some are in sessions, some are in screenings, some are in meetings, some are in the lobby connecting with others, trying to writers looking for producers, things like this. And we then looked and said, how do we put all of this together online? If we were a furniture trade show, it would be real easy. Here's pictures of the couches. Who wants to place an order? There's the company you go to. Most trade shows or trade events are limited audiences. Ours are much more complex. And so it took us a lot of time sort of to put those pieces together. And I can walk you through sort of what we've done.
I'd love to hear. I'm fascinated.
Some of the pieces. The first thing we found, we looked for platforms. As you mentioned, CAN, they used, beyond Sonando, they used other platforms that they licensed or modified from third parties. And none of us can create this stuff from scratch. We don't have the economics or the time to do that. So we looked at a lot of platforms. And the first thing we saw on almost every platform, including the ones CAN used, is you were navigating a website with navigation bars and submenus and drop-downs. And as we would go through each one, it was sort of like being in a theater and someone turned on the lights. The experience was really not there. You were more aware of your surroundings than being engulfed in your experience. And so this really sent us on a path to make sure that we could do as much as possible to have the event engaging and not have you feel like you're sitting there with clicks and everything else and drop downs and menus and discovering how this website worked. So the only way to do this for us was to bring in multiple different technology providers that each were specialists in their areas, and then to build out ourselves where that wasn't available. And just ticking off the pieces very briefly, and then you can let me know where you want to maybe dive into. For the companies who usually have space at the market, we created pages for them where they could display their films, where they could show videos, they could show their team, and they could also say how they wanted to be contacted. Now, one thing we learned from CAN was most of the buyers and sellers did not want to use the CAN platform to communicate. They didn't want to click on and use that video discussion. They were okay in Skype. They were okay in Zoom. They were okay in some other third-party apps that are maybe specific to the film industry that they liked, but they didn't want to yet learn another platform. And so in going forward, we made the decision that for buyers and sellers, we weren't going to put forward the video platform, that they would have their own way of connecting and meeting. So the first thing we've done is we've developed a series of pages where the exhibitors can be found. You click on a logo of the company, you see everything that the company is doing. And we also did the same for the film commissions and production facilities. But what we did was, and we'll get you an image that maybe you'll be able to put up on the screen later, we created a map, essentially a city map with 8 buildings on it. And each of those buildings are interactive. So when you arrive at the AFM, you see a map with 8 buildings. You click on the industry offices, and you're immediately in an environment where you're seeing all of the sales companies who are there, and you can navigate through just by clicking on icons, seeing what they're doing, and seeing how they want to be contacted. And it's the same thing for the film commissions. We set up a separate building called Location Expo. Click on that image, and there you are seeing them as well. The only piece I'd say is somewhat traditional from a website standpoint. We created another building called MyAFM. Now, this is where participants come in and establish their profile, upload their image, talk about what they're doing. Are they writers? Are they producers, directors? packages they may be bringing to the market, their social media links. This is where there's a little bit of a traditional, here's who I am, and I want the world to be able to discover me. And there they can, if they want, send messages and have Zoom meetings within that platform and invitations. That's, if you will, the, quote, traditional online piece of this. But then what we really started to focus on was, how do we create the serendipity of a live event where you're in an elevator and you bump into somebody you would have not have sent a message to? You're sitting at a bar talking to someone. You're at a conference and the people sitting on either side of you, you haven't met before. You open up a conversation. If what I've learned from participants of the AFM, it's beyond the education, beyond the transactions. If they walk away having met three or four people that they will continue to work with and they are meaningful relationships that will impact their career or projects, the event was a success. It's all about face-to-face. And so we went looking for how to create a platform or to find a platform that would do this. And we're really excited about what we're doing in another one of our buildings, which is called the Networking Building. When you arrive in this building, you see a floor plan of about 15 tables with chairs around each table. You can click on any table and actually have a seat at that table. You can mouse over the other tables, see who's sitting there, and have a little pop-up, and you see their names and who they are and their titles or what they're doing. The object being to be able to have face-to-face meetings, but to do them in a way that is not appointment-based like you might see with Zoom. And in this building, this networking building, which has 8 or 9 floors, 15 tables or so on every floor, you click on a floor like an elevator and you're taken up to the next floor. All of these tables are labeled in terms of topics. So let's say on the 8th floor and table 4, we have 2 topics for horror micro budget. And we've scheduled those tables to be horror micro budget at 2, 4, and 6 in the afternoon. And we put that out on our schedule. So if horror micro budget is something that interests you, and you don't know who else at the market has an interest in that as well, you can just drop in at that table. It's limited to only 6 people. And you can meet people who are interested in that topic. So we will have dozens and dozens, between 50 and 60 tables, with topics changing every hour. Topics will be based on genre. Some will be based on geography. You know, meetups from people coming from Russia. Well, it doesn't mean that everybody from Russia knows each other, or everybody from Germany, or everybody from Australia. So they're almost like scheduled meetups. So we have topics on genre, we have topics based on geography, topics of producers looking for other producers to work with, writers and producers looking to connect. And so you can constantly jump into these tables, and, you know, if the conversation doesn't work, you jump off to another table. There are also some private tables. So if you see you're in a room of 6 and you realize that you and one other person, maybe you just want to jump off to a different table, you can. And we're also allowing the participants to reserve or name their own table, which means during the market, let's say the Atlanta Producers Association wants to have a meetup the next day at 4 in the afternoon. Sure, we'll reserve a table. It's like having a reserved table in a restaurant or a bar. The sign is up there, it's reserved, and they can jump into that table whenever they like. This technology comes to us from a company called Filmocracy. It's new. It's only been used probably about 8 or 9 times. We're taking a little bit of a risk. It's well out of beta, but there's still things that are that need to be worked on. But the whole idea here is to drop into the networking building and seek out those that you want to meet. I guess the best analogy, Alex, would be if you were walking into a networking party, mm-hmm. and there were 500 people and there were discussions going everywhere and you didn't know a single person. You could go from group to group, introduce yourself, and spend 2 hours and never meet anybody. Right. That actually was right for you to connect with. Now imagine you walk into that party and magically there's a little bubble over every conversation.
Right.
That's telling you what they're talking about. And you can go, French documentary? No, not for me. I'm going over there. They're talking about what I want to talk about. That's what these tables do. People drop in. The conversations are pre-labeled. You know which ones to drop in on and who to meet. And everybody coming to a market wants to meet people. It isn't that you're dropping in and interrupting. Sure, there's going to be a conversation, just like walking into a group at a party. you know, you just don't interrupt and blurt out. You know, you work your way into a discussion. It's going to be the same here. We're really excited about that. The two other buildings that have our sessions, we're going to be running two stages, simultaneously. So we'll have about 70 or 74 sessions changing over every 90 minutes. They are in buildings that are similar to that networking building. So while you're sitting at a table waiting for a session to start, you're still able to meet the people who happen to be randomly placed next to you. But of course, once the session starts, then your screen is wiped and you're seeing the speakers. So there's a little bit of that serendipity there, like walking into a ballroom and just grabbing a seat. The same thing will happen there.
It sounds almost, I mean, almost heavenly. I mean, in all honesty, it sounds, I mean, if everything gets pulled off correctly, I mean, this sounds wonderful because it cuts through a lot of the time wasted in the physical kind of situation. Well, and I know you don't want to like, hey, you know, we still want to do the physical eventually. We're going to get back to that. But this is, which brings me to the next question. Do you see a virtual component from this point on at AFM?
Yes. And let me back up to one thing you said, which was, we looked at the technology and said, how can we make it better than face-to-face? As we know, there's certain things just as consumers we do where the technology is making things better. There are other things that aren't as good. I'll give you an example. Inside the Lowe's, if you're a producer with a script, inside the Lowe's, you can go door-to-door walking in to sales companies. Now, some will turn you away. They're busy. Others, you may catch a moment and have a meeting. That transaction-based piece of the AFM really isn't present for producers online because while you might get turned away in an office, you've actually walked into the office and you've had a chat with someone who said, no, we're busy. Online, it's an email that may not be answered.
Right.
And so we had to turn our focus away from transaction and towards face-to-face. Even in Santa Monica, we find when we do post-show surveys, those who come in with a very narrow transaction purpose are usually the ones that are the most unhappy. They only came in for one if somebody isn't interested in buying whatever they have, their script, their production, investing, they just go on to the next person. That's all they're there for. They're usually the ones who are most unhappy. Those who get the most out of the market realize they're there to learn and to connect and build relationships. Eventually, hopefully, one leads to whatever their, you know, their primary goal is with their project or career. So we've looked at technology. One other piece, and then I'll come back to next year. There's also an on-demand theater. You click on theater. Again, it's another building. It says theater. You click on the theater, and you're taken off to our screening room, which presents, I think we're up to about 180. It'll probably be around 220, 230 films. We're just like on Netflix. You're seeing the image of each film, and you're clicking on the films you want to see and immediately starting a screening. One of the things Cannes did was they decided to have their films screening based on appointment, meaning there is a defined time. If it was 10 a.m. in London, it was going to play at 10 a.m. in London, then 10 a.m. in New York, then 10 a.m. in L.A., and you had to put it on your schedule. It was appointment-based screenings. And in talking to a lot of the sales companies, we found that the benefit of technology was I didn't have to be someplace at that moment.
It's like it's versus Netflix versus old school terrestrial NBC.
Right. And you know, one of the problems when we screen in Santa Monica, we have 29 auditoriums that every 2 hours are playing a different film. And some films only screen once. So you have 28 other films competing with you, plus the ability to meet with 400 companies in their offices. Our average screening at a market, and it's similar to Cannes in their physical market, is about 28 to 30 people because everybody has so much to do. Now, imagine that film being available in a theater in Santa Monica nonstop in its own auditorium for 5 or 6 days. You know that everybody who wanted to see it would eventually. So we didn't go to appointment-based. We went to on-demand. And
so much better.
It's a different way to, you know, it's using the technology we hope to make the event better. But looking to, you asked about 2021. Now, we'll have to see, is it 21 or 22?
25, who knows?
Anything going on, I prefer, you know, 3/4 full and we're going to be optimistic. what we know people will find from the online experience that they're having over the last 6 months, probably the next six, is certain things they used to do outside of their home or office, they now can do inside. Whether it's us as consumers or people in business, less business travel, more conversations like you and I are having now. There are a lot of participants at film markets. We have people from between 75 and 80 countries. There are a lot of participants who can't go to every market every year. It's just not viable. You look at a buyer from, let's say, a small country like Chile. The economics of going to Cannes, Berlin, and AFM every year don't make sense. Now, a buyer coming from, let's say, the UK, where they're buying for a much bigger economy, so they're spending a lot more, the travel is not that big a piece of their overall company budget. So we sometimes see at the AFM, certain countries have only a once every two or three year visibility, or certain companies, I should say, from smaller places. We also see something else, which is those who know they aren't coming, they aren't the most important participants. Let's say your most important participants are big producers or big buyers from Japan and the UK and Germany. They're going to get their meetings in the first two or three days. Those who may be, I don't want to say less important, but don't, let's say you're a buyer from Greece again. Not as high profile. We find in Santa Monica, they may arrive a couple days later. We even tell our producers, don't arrive till the fourth day. You know, most of the companies with offices, they're too busy with preset meetings. Don't come the first 3 days. You're more relevant later. Well, what we're going to find is a lot of those companies are going to say, great, not only will I not come late, I'm just not going to come at all. Because the AFM is going to give me an online way to participate the week after the film market is in Santa Monica. What we don't believe works is what people call hybrid events. Some are participating online at the same time, some are participating physically. That can work for a conference. You point the camera, some people are in the audience and some people are watching on TV. All talk shows operate. That part's easy. But when you look at the interaction, there isn't a company with an office inside the Lowe's in Santa Monica that's going to interrupt a meeting with someone standing in front of them for someone who just decided to randomly click and say, let's talk on a computer, right, and vice versa. So what we're really looking at is that the market will continue, but some of those companies who couldn't participate at all, they could only travel once every two or three years, now will have an opportunity to continue to travel, to participate in what would be a second week, where all of the companies who have offices, who came to the market, who were in the conferences, then back home are able to log in, see additional sessions, as well as see all of the companies who are now back at their home office and ready to have follow-up meetings with the companies who didn't travel in an organized way by the market with defined dates and defined hours. And now we're 14 months away from that, 13 months right away, and a lot of the world may change, but that's we view this as really sequential rather than concurrent.
That makes actually it makes a lot of sense to do that. I mean, obviously this year will be completely virtual, so right, it's a complete kind of.
I'm going to interrupt you one thing. I apologize for this. No one on our team is allowed to use the word virtual.
What's the word we use?
We use the word online. Virtual, online. If you look it up, means almost, not quite. Not quite there. We are an online market. We aren't – virtual is coming really more from, I understand, virtual reality. But
sure. I got you. Fair enough. Yeah. So, Potato, potato. I get it.
There you go.
It makes all the sense in the world to now – open yourself up to an online component, which this is where this would go. We all knew this is where this was going to go. I mean, AFM, you know, I think this year was going to be less actual days, correct?
We shortened the market by 2 days. Right.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. And Cannes as well, and all major markets. We all knew this was coming. This is not a big surprise. COVID has just ramped everything up and sped everything up so fast that now we're forced to do something that I don't think you had in your plans an online component this year, did you? Pre-COVID?
No, sir.
Exactly. It wasn't something that was even in your mind. So I'm really interested to see how it works out for you guys, how it works out for you personally, AFM, as on a business standpoint, because of there's a substantial, I'm not sure, and I don't want to get into your economics, but the cost differences between running a physical event versus running an online event, and what the ROI is and all of that stuff. I know there will always be a physical component, and I agree with you. I want to go to a film festival. I don't want to go to Sundance online. Like, I want to go to Park City and enjoy that time. I want to go to AFM and, oh, I just bumped into somebody. And there's only so much you could do online that to create that kind of serendipity that happens at an event like AFM. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show. But I agree with you 100% that because you have this online component, and even moving forward, having the second week being an online only situation will open up the AFM to a monstrous amount of people that want to attend, filmmakers, buyers from around the world that would just could not afford to fly in because it didn't make financial sense to do so.
Yeah, that's how we feel. That will engage an audience that couldn't otherwise participate, and hopefully grow into a new audience that could never go there. And so this is really a test for us. It's not only filling the void that would be there if we weren't doing a market this fall, but it's also understanding what pieces can work well in tandem with a physical market next year.
Now, how do you see traditional film markets playing a part in film distribution moving forward? Because, I mean, again, the game has changed so dramatically since 81. So when AFM was born to now, I mean, even in the short time that I've been going over the last 4 or 5 years, I've seen a change. Can you imagine 2015 versus 2020? How much has the business changed in just those 5 years? So what part do you see film markets in general, but then at the AFM, you know, in the whole ecosystem of film distribution?
You know, that's one of those questions you take a deep breath before you answer. I think the first and most important thing is film markets provide an opportunity for exchanging information. And I just don't mean a producer sitting in a conference, but we will see buyers and sellers. When I refer to buyers, I need to be clear, we're talking about territorial distributors. Sometimes producers will think a buyer is someone who's going to buy their script. When we talk about buyers in a film market, we're talking about territorial distributors that have online platforms, they have television networks, they have, they're distributing to theaters or even in shrink wrap and Blu-ray. We will have buyers and sellers participate solely for the purpose of marketplace intelligence. The company that doesn't have a film ready at the moment will still have an office and still take a meeting with 100 buyers just to understand what's the marketplace like in Japan, what's working, how are the windows going, because when they're deciding what to make or what to invest in, that's a film that may not hit the marketplace for 18 months. They've got to guess right. You talk about the acceleration of change right now. That's the scary part. You know, you go back, 20, 25 years ago, the world wasn't changing that much from 1 year to the other. Well, sci-fi went up a little bit, horror went down a little bit.
What are these VHSs? What are these things? Yeah.
When I worked in distribution, we were able to forecast the value of second cycle syndication in Italy. We would go out that far. I'm serious.
Wow, that's awesome.
Determining the ultimate value of a film would have, because you could just see it all play out. And, most of that long tail has melted completely. And it's changing so quickly that companies need to be there. And if we're talking about senior executives at platforms and distribution companies all over the world needing to travel for marketplace intelligence, you can imagine what producers and writers need to do to keep up with that, to know what kind of content they should be pursuing that's going to resonate in the marketplace. And so markets and trade fairs, really in any industry, that it's so important. But in our industry, where the pace of change is just going faster and faster, that's going to be the most important piece. This is still a face-to-face business. Mm-hmm. When a director has a vision for a film and you're a buyer and you're deciding whether to take a risk on that territory by territory, you sometimes want to look that director in the eye and really understand and ask questions. And you can do a point online, but there's something about being face to face and developing that trust. That trust when the salesperson says the film will be good. Mm-hmm. Is that trust factor. And that's done, that's best done face to face. So the markets, I see the markets continuing just like they are. Again, when we look at the film industry, look at our film market, I think we're very unique. We are. The product we have is very unique. The way we sell it is unique. The way it's financed is unlike any other business in the world. But the fact is, there are trade fairs in thousands of industries, from CES, you know, to restaurants, to furniture, whatever it is. They all have a reason to get together. And so we also study what is going on in the trade fair world to see what best practices work and what the changes are there as well. So not only our own industry, but we have to layer in what goes on in the event industry. So, shorter market, yes. An online component, yes. But people will still get together.
I can't wait for that that online furniture market. That I mean, how do you make that work? Like,
how do you sit on a couch and see how soft it is?
Exactly. How do you sit on a couch and see how that is? So I wanted to ask you. Well, first of all, I wanted to ask you a question. Do you? If I would have told you in February, if you and I would just have having a coffee in Santa Monica talking about AFM coming up this year, and I would say, hey, Jonathan, you know what, man? I think the entire theatrical side of the business is going to shut down worldwide, and we're not going to have a blockbuster summer season for the first time since Jaws was released in the 70s, you would have looked at me like I was absolutely insane and walked the other way.
Well, there are people that believe the earth is flat, so...
So the theatrical side of our business has been devastated. It is, I mean, the studios are still trying to figure out what to do, let alone the independents. I mean, you've got movies like Tenet, Wonder Woman, Black Widow, big Marvel studios, Mulan, these kind of big tentpole films who are just trying to figure out what to do, let alone us, you know, small fries in the business. How do you, I just want to hear your opinion. Do you think the theatrical experience is, I personally don't think it's dead, but it is on life support and it will take a moment for it to come back to even remotely close. And I don't think we'll ever get back to where it was pre-COVID because there's just going to be less screens. There's going to be less everything because companies are going to go under and so on. What's your opinion on the whole theatrical side of our business?
Well, we all know that most businesses will come back in some form. It's not a matter of if, but to what degree and what gets lost by this. You know, there are deferred things and there are things that are just lost forever. The theatrical business will be back. Well, let's use the right word. The exhibition business will return. You know, we've always, you know, we're a communal species. Mm-hmm. You know, we want to laugh and scream and cry together. I suppose you could go back to the cavemen sitting around a fire and somebody jumping up and telling something and everybody else laughing. You know, it's we want to do this as a group. The question is, when it comes back, I think your first question is, will there be as many screens? We already saw, you know, independents, and I talk about the independent exhibitors around the country being challenged as the business models have evolved, and a lot of the lower budget films were just not seeking theatrical releases, and the studios were bypassing a lot of these independents to go straight to the big chains. This may accelerate some of that and hurt some of those smaller chains. Setting aside, because I don't know the economics of AMC and Regal, and you know, will they keep all of their locations and leases and things like that? But taking assumption that most of their screens are still open and viable as we come out of the pandemic. Sure, we're going to see everyone back in theaters. They're going to be watching films, I believe, in crowded theaters. Now, whether it's 8 months from now or 18 months from now, we'll have to see. The question is, what is it that are they seeing? And has this accelerated the move towards tentpoles, where you only have really, you know, it's AMC, you used to have a phrase called a film buyer. A film buyer was someone, if we look back before the evolution of multiplexes, So going back from the 1920s till probably the early 80s, a film buyer would see a film and would make a decision on how long they were going to play and commit to a certain number of weeks. And if they were wrong, that theater was just empty and they made a horrible decision. The biggest risk of exhibition was booking a film and then having the film tank. And so film buyers were really experts. Today, a lot of the exhibitors refer to their film buyers as programmers. They're no longer in the buying business. They have screens to program the way Disney has multiple channels to program. I've got that film coming in. I'm going to drop it in five screens. I'm going to program it in five screens. We'll see how it does. I'll pull it down to three after a few days. It doesn't do well. They're all programmers, and this is how they operate. And they operate best when they're programming mega hits or giant blockbuster films. When you bring them a film that might fill the screen twice a day, it's a small film, and it probably won't play well except on the weekends. Yeah, some try and squeeze it in to be good to the industry or to touch, you know, a segment of the community they might not otherwise reach. But for the most part, they're going to ignore them more and more. And that's going to be a challenge. And this is where I hope when we look at exhibitors like Lemley, that they come out of this okay.
Yeah.
Because these are kinds of companies that, you know, for those who aren't in Southern California, Lemley Theaters, it's a terrific chain of people who really believe in film and the creative process. Will those exhibitors still be there? Because I don't have the faith that the larger chains will continue to serve the smaller films. And so eventually your multiplex will be just another version of Netflix. You'll see, you know, which three or four big films happen to be on there. And so that's my worry. But I think it'll be back. I think it'll be crowded. The popcorn business won't die.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think they will come back eventually. When that moment will be, I it could be, like you said, 8 months, 18 months or longer with it. But this, on a business standpoint, is there a business model that makes sense for a $300 million plus film, including marketing and P&A, or $400 million, which a lot of these tentpoles, like $200 million to make it, $200 million to market it. Is there a business model that makes sense without a theatrical? Like, because I know Mulan released on Disney Plus. From what I understand, it did fairly well for a. It was a tentpole, but it wasn't like, you know, it wasn't Wonder Woman. It wasn't a Marvel movie. It wasn't James Bond. It wasn't something monstrous. It was just, you know, a big Disney movie. You know, is there moving forward? I mean, you saw that article with Disney, right? That they said they're restructuring their entire company for
following AT&T, Warner, and following the others, right?
So that's pretty much a huge shot across the bow of the theatrical business. They're like, hey, we're going to still do you guys, but we got Disney Plus. I mean, what have they, 60 million, 70 million subscribers in less than a year? It's insanity.
Well, the film business has never been viewed by business people as a business. Television has been viewed as a business. Most businesses, you make a product. If it works, you just make more of the same product. TV series, that's what that's been like. Now, when I was growing up, ABC had Movies of the Week, MOW.
Yeah.
They'd have a new movie. Well, they did this for 6, 7, 8 years. I don't know how long it was, and they stopped. They stopped. Why? Because they had to have a brand new marketing campaign every 7 days for one of those films. They didn't have to do that for series. The series takes off. You market the first few weeks. If the characters and storylines resonate, now you just have something that's now in orbit. And so the business world could relate to the television industry. You know, if you go to film markets, you see people in jeans and, you know, and leather jackets. You go to TV markets, they're in coat and tie. It's a totally, totally different vibe. And so what's happened is the film companies have become smaller and smaller pieces of these giant corporations that are businesses. See, the film business has always been about two guys. Oh, it's the Laddie regime over at Fox. That means it's just one guy who's picking films. Or maybe it may be somebody else at a different studio. It's always been at the end of the day. Yes, you can say there's a committee and a few people look at it. But at the end of the day, most film studios have been about one or two people and their decisions. And if you ask Wall Street or the business world, is that a business? They say, no, I'm investing in two people. And so So that's the challenge that the film industry has always faced. And now these film companies are just small divisions with bottom line responsibility, just like the guy running the other TV network, and I'm running the film stuff. So the way they make their decisions are totally different. Now, you mentioned very expensive films on demand. We need to separate that discussion between TVOD, where they're paying for something for each viewing, and SVOD. You mentioned one film. I'm sorry, the Disney film.
So like Mulan. Mulan was a PVOD, which is a new thing that.
Yes. Then you look at Netflix with The Irishman, and you compare the two.
Two different business models.
Yes, and the subscription model is really interesting because the Netflix knew or discovered what magazine publishers have known for a century.
Right.
That there are one or two sections of the book that you like, you will maintain your subscription. And so what Netflix did in its growing years was made sure it had something for everyone. They had documentaries. They had lower budget. They had every comedian you could think of. Whatever it was, they had a little bit of everything, including a blockbuster. One, I guess 3 or 4 years ago, they went to Sundance and I think they spent $16, $17 million on a film. And the whole industry was writing articles. There's no chance that Netflix buying this film is going to get $17 million. And then 4 weeks later, there's an article that the amount of media coverage that Netflix got on mainstream media outside of the entertainment industry was valued at about $50 million because they had spent so much. And Netflix looks at this and it's just like doing a premiere party. Your primary purpose is just to get media coverage. They spent 17 on the film and they got 50 million in coverage. Their goal was not for that film to break even or to have any kind of certain value in terms of eyeballs and downloads. It was to make sure that they were building their subscription business. And that's why you'll see them have an Irishman, whether it's every few months or whatever it is. They'll have it just often enough that you say, I can't miss Netflix. There are four or five, and because it'll never be on another platform. I'd be missing 3 or 4 blockbusters a year. How could I do that?
Or more now, like one a month now.
So here's my $9. And that's different than Mulan, where they were looking and saying, our Disney Plus model is not ready to just drop this in as a value of a subscription. We need to do this on a transaction basis to pull in some revenue first. And so, you know, smarter people than me are struggling to see which model is going to work, how, what kind of films, where's the consumer, you know, going to gravitate toward it. And it may be the kids' films that all of a sudden the family, instead of all the expenses going to the theater, you know, you can have 6 kids and have a movie afternoon, and you're willing to pay $29 to have it at home and do everything there.
I don't mean to interrupt you, but I just saw a trailer for the new Pixar movie, Soul. That's being released on Disney Plus on Christmas. Part of the subscription, not as PVOD. And they did the same thing with the last movie, the last Pixar movie they did. So I'm starting to see a pattern where like some of the bigger animated films make sense for the Disney Plus model. Because those they cost $100 million change generally to make one of those Pixar films. But Mulan, like I'm curious to see I know Warner Brothers just said that Wonder Woman is going to be released. On PVOD. And I think they're still talking about Black Widow, which is the next big Marvel movie. Poor Bond. Bond is just being bumped around. I mean, poor Bond is just...
MGM wanted to really sell itself somewhere. I was hoping to use this as, you know, just some excitement.
They can't, like, poor Bond's just sitting on a shelf somewhere, and it's just like, okay, maybe next summer. Oh, maybe a lot of things are being pushed till next summer, but there's also so much real estate. Like there's only so many movies you can release on a day during the summer. So it's just an insane time. But you made some very good points I hadn't really thought about before about the business models of television, the way you look at it as on a business standpoint. It makes all the sense in the world. I personally think the PVOD, I think that the model that Mulan set up, if you've got a Disney Plus, so we're talking Universal that has Peacock and Warner's who has HBO Max – I know Paramount's trying to do something. Who knows what will happen with that?
Yeah, they'll do something with whether it's Paramount Plus or CBS Plus or something. They'll get there.
They'll have some sort of avenue for it. So then the PVOD business model, does make a lot of sense for like a Mulan where they said they sold 9 million tickets at $30 a pop. Well, they keep 100% of that. So we're talking 200 and whatever, $70 million plus for opening weekend. It's not too shabby. Would they have made a billion worldwide? And they're still going theatrically overseas, and they're still selling it other places as well. So it's just we're in the unknown. This is so unprecedented that nobody, like you said, people much smarter than you and me are having trouble figuring this all out.
And now they have, you know, again, we're talking about the studios, not the independents, but even when the world sort of settles down and we're back to some sense of normalcy, they're still going to have choices. If you made a $300 million film, a $200 million film 10 years ago, you were going out to the theaters. There was no chance you were going to what was called an ancillary market to drop that film first.
Right.
But now when the film is done, you might look and say that given the marketing cost of going out theatrically, and you're not quite as thrilled with maybe the results the film might get, that it's going to play to a narrower core audience that really wants that particular thing, you can pivot. This is going to allow pivots both to TVOD and SVOD. Well, we inside the industry might know, we know why they're moving it here or there. The rest of the world doesn't pay attention to that. You know, the rest of the world just sees this is where the film's available, and this is a benefit I get either of my subscription or be able to buy it as a transaction. So they'll be able to monetize each of these films more efficiently. And that's, you know, again, 10 years ago, and I just use this as a comparison, the average theatrical film only returned from the box office about 60% of its marketing costs. Most theatrical films, theatrical was viewed as a loss leader to set up video and Blu-ray and the other ancillaries. And I'm not talking about big blockbusters, but middle range budget films. The average one just never covered their marketing costs. And so the fact that you hear Disney going out and getting, what, 30 times 9 million?
Yeah.
Somebody's smiling over there.
I mean, and that was first weekend, so I'm assuming it's still generating revenue, and they don't have to split that with the theater, so it's 100% theirs. I mean, the business model is sound, and could an Avengers-style film go to PVOD and make $1 billion over the weekend? I mean, you know, the old Mike Tyson boxing matches used to pull in $250, $350 million in one night, if you remember.
But you look at someone, and we're all different in what we go to films for. When someone tells me there's a $300 million action-adventure
I want to see it in the theater. Yeah.
I'm paying $15 to see a $300 million piece of art. Right. I'm willing to do that.
Yes.
You know, and so it depends on just the environment you want to see it in.
No, absolutely. And do you personally think that there is an option – because I've been saying this a lot, and I think this is going to happen within the next 12 to 18 months, that one of these four companies is just going to come in and buy an AMC or Regal or an Arclight and just put it under their banner and change their business model, which is Amazon, Facebook, Google, or Apple, who are so cash flush that they can come in and buy.
I don't think so. Again, okay. It's just the guy's opinion, but why take the risk? If any one of them came and basically said, we're going to do an exclusive for you, we're going to lease your theaters for a while, we're going to put everything. I hate to say this, the theater owners have never really been in the film business for the last 30 or 40 years. Right. You know, they get more revenue from the popcorn.
Sure.
And everything else. If they can rent those theaters at a better price than taking the risk of playing films, I think if you were an Apple or something like that and you want to do something, you just come and start leasing. You could just take over screens, own screens. You know, again, there was a time in the earlier part of our industry where certain studios only played certain exhibitors. When I was in, I grew up around Westwood Village where all the premieres were. And you know, it's Orion as it grew. And this is in the late 70s, early 80s. I was younger. They actually had to convince United Artists to go build their theaters to build a new multiplex so that they could have a place to play their films, because each of the screens in Westwood was controlled solely by one studio. That screen would only play that studio most of the time. And so it's easy to come back to, you know, the consent decree is gone. It's easy for the exhibitors to really cut the kinds of deals with studios if the studio wants, that there's just no reason to get into this world of you know, minimum wage ticket takers, leases in shopping malls. You know, they've got a lot of issues in the exhibition business that the studios may not want, including the people who are cleaning the theaters. And there's lots of stories about how workers are sort of underpaid in this world. And it's just not what the studios, I don't see any of them wanting to get in this exhibition business.
Interesting.
Being a landowner and being stuck with 30-year leases. They want to be nimble.
Right. Yeah. When you have something like a PVOD situation like Mulan, you're like, I just made a cool $300 million and I just clicked the button.
Don't need it. It's just too easy for them to go in and, you know, write a check and control something for a while.
Okay. That's an interesting point of view. I like that. I appreciate that. Now, is there a business model moving forward that filmmakers can use? Like, how can filmmakers package their films so it's more appetizing for international buyers? Because I know that's a big question I get asked all the time.
The key thing about – we talk about the topic of pre-sales, and I know you've probably talked about this many, many times, and those listening, I hope or should know, you know, a lot about what pre-sale means, which is the buyers around the world are buying the film before it's made, and the producer-distributor can then – take those promises, those contracts, and go use it with the bank to finance the film. When you're buying a film that hasn't been made, you're taking two risks. One, of course, is you know, will the film work in my country for the price that I'm paying? Is the right value? But the other is, will the film be good? And if the film's finished, you can make your own determination. If the film hasn't been made, you're taking that secondary risk. And so the buyers internationally still today, and this has been true for 30, 40 years, the buyers still today, if they're looking at pre-buying, they're going to be more apt to pre-buy genres that are not dependent on a good execution. Now, what do I mean by a good execution? If you're making Expendables 44, you just sort of know what you're going to get. If you're making The Green Book, a fabulous film, but when you read the script, it's all based on the skill of the director.
And the actors. And the writer, yeah.
And the writers, and you're looking at this and say it could be great. Brokeback Mountain, I could go back a ways, but there are lots of films that when you look at the script, you say this is dependent on execution. Well, genres that are less dependent on execution, action adventure, comedy that's not about the words but more about the sight gags, horror, thriller, erotic. There are various genres that are less dependent on execution. And so if a producer and writer, if their goal is to sell something, you know, you look at artists and some artists will say, well, I paint for myself. I paint the same lake every week and I give it to my grandkids. That's swell. If you're an artist and you're making it for yourself, then you don't need to listen to anything I'm talking about. But if the purpose is to sell something, you want to head towards genres that there's less risk in execution and that the marketplace seems to be interested in. Now, right now, the marketplace is less interested in horror. Horror is taking a little bit of a dip. Why? Because there's so many just frightening things that are going on around our lives right now on television, everywhere else, that romantic comedies are doing much better today. And if you looked in the 1930s, the height of the Depression, this is where we see all these films about the ultra rich and their problems. And many of them are romantic comedies. And it's somewhat similar right now. Hallmark is doing swell with all of these films. So if you're a filmmaker looking to sell something, you want to look to sell something that buyers have and production companies have less fear about the execution. And that at least that's one piece that helps. Obviously, you want to have a story that people want to know how it ends.
Right, exactly. And then, of course, if you have cast that is bankable, depending overseas who they are, that always helps. Anytime you can have cast
or any type of embedded IP, whether the IP could be a true story, based on someone else's life, whatever that is. The cast is, when you talk about paying, you know, certain cast more than others, it's usually not because they're a better actor or actress. It's because their name recognition gives you marketing value. And IP can do the same thing. It's what's that one hook? One of the things that independence can do is to write a script that has one huge, terrific role for a man or a woman. That if you look at Charlize Theron in Monster, this is a film that while its budget keeps going up, it was about as time goes on, it's about a $4 million film. But she looked at the script, and this had a role of a lifetime in it. Ensembles are the toughest things to do because you don't have the budget to get anybody. Writing a film that's got one absolutely terrific role, you've got a good chance, if it's a great story, of finding someone that says, yeah, I'll take a risk on that film. It's a role of a lifetime. Big single roles. The last thing you want to do is ensemble coming-of-age stories about small-town U.S. And this is the one problem with writers, those who teach writing say, write about what you know. And then all we see is high school and college, Midwest coming-of-age stories with an ensemble cast that are tough to make and even tougher to sell. Don't focus on ensemble. Try and stay within a specific genre. Those that is less dependent on execution. Those would be two pieces of advice.
That's a great, great pieces of advice, sir. Now I have to ask you, how many COVID films do you think are going to be at AFM this year? And how many of them will be promptly rejected?
People watch some of these films about diseases and things like that in March. They were saying, but people run from them, again, like they're running from horror now. The real question is films before the camera, what year is the film taking place in? Are we going to be shooting 2019 for the next 3 years? Because we're surely not shooting 2020 in most films. You're not going to see people walking around with masks on. They're not going to date the film as being in this 12 or 18 month bubble. So we have to look and see what year are they shooting? And we may be living in 2019 for the next 3 years.
Yeah, that's a great point. It's a great point. Yeah, I was just watching a show that came back on, and they are hitting COVID like straight on. They're like, it's taking place now. Our characters are going through it. There's masks. They're making jokes of it.
Talk about a series.
A sitcom. Yeah, it's a sitcom series. Yeah, not a movie. A sitcom series. And that's a series.
You want to stay topical. You want to stay current. And of course, we all see this. But when you get into features, and you want that feature to have a long life.
You can't make it like – it's like a 9/11 movie or a Vietnam movie. Like those they are specific about a certain thing. Like, and I was always – I tell people as well, like how many 9/11 movies were there? And it didn't happen while 9/11 – like a month after 9/11. Like it took a while. Vietnam films didn't happen in the 70s generally. I mean late 70s – Deer right. Hunter was probably the earliest one. But it took a while before people got comfortable to even start talking about it again.
If you see a feature film with people with masks on, it means that the part of the storyline has to do with COVID. Otherwise, they're shooting 2019.
Right, exactly. And I've had so many filmmakers like, "Hey, I'm going to be the first one to make a COVID horror movie." I'm like, "Don't do that. Nobody wants that."
Please no.
Please, nobody wants to watch that. I don't care if it's amazing. You'll never get anyone to see it. So please, anyone listening, don't make a COVID-based film. Make a film that has a story that might have some people wearing masks and dealing with it. That's fine. But even then, you're right. It gets stuck in this bubble.
I do expect someone to do Love in the Time of COVID.
I was waiting for that too. I think we're all waiting. We're all waiting for that. Yes. And that last question I have for you, Jonathan, where do you see how do you see the film distribution landscape changing in the next 12 months, 12 to 18 months? Because it's changing almost on a monthly basis at this point.
We've almost covered it. It's when we talk about film distribution, we just talk about all the channels from exhibition to all of the VODs, transactions, subscription, audience-based, if we're advertising-based, if I see any bubble that sort of is under the radar, it's an AVOD, advertising supported VOD, where there's a lot more going on. And we're finding a lot of independent films are getting traction on AVOD platforms that are doing a good job of programming based on certain genres and what you might, they're just not taking one of everything like a Netflix. They're very specific and most of them are free. And so I think there's a growth sort of, because it's almost coming back to traditional advertising supported television, but it's on demand. And so for independent film, I see AVOD as, and I should say lower budget independent film, AVOD is an interesting area. But from a studio standpoint, we're just going to see more of it looking at as programming. The one piece that I struggle with a little bit, you know, we've been an organization that has always supported the entrepreneur. And when we look at production right now, if you're an actor, a set designer, a director, a writer, this is really a terrific time. There's more being shot right now in hours of television. Setting aside COVID for a minute, which is having more of an impact on features than anything else because of the insurance issue. But what we have in this country, 475 narrative TV series. I mean, the amount of filmed entertainment is huge. But what is happening is we've gone away from the entrepreneur producer who would work hard on their own, find a writer, put something together, and then have an ownership piece in that film. Right. And if it was successful, something to live on to the next film. Writers and directors and actors have residuals. They have an ongoing piece of what goes on with their film. But now more and more, we've seen first Netflix, it's a straight buyout and the producer is given a check and they're done forever. Now we've seen Disney going the same way with, yes, there are a few bonuses. You get into a festival, if you hit a certain number, we'll give you a bonus, but you have no right to see any of the economics. There's no such thing as profit and loss and studio accounting anymore. And so what this is chipping away at is it's chipping away at the entrepreneur, the risk taker who saw a project and championed it all the way through. We're now back to corporate people who are looking to see what they're going to write the check for. And so when we talk about what's the future of distribution, we got to go back to say, what is it that they're distributing? Because the content may determine what's going out. And part of my worry a little bit, what we want to watch for and support, are the entrepreneurs, the companies that are bubbling up that are still providing rewards to those who can bring great stories forward.
That's a great analysis. And it is changing so rapidly. The economics for being a filmmaker has, before you, like the days, I was telling people the other day, like the days of Friends and the residual checks for Seinfeld, that's gone. That is gone. Those, you know, that they make $20 million a year still off of Friends, you know, every year is not going to be a thing, post Big Bang Theory. Like it's any new shows today, especially if you go to a streaming platform, who is not going to keep, Netflix's oldest show is maybe six seasons. They don't keep it around that long.
They don't need to, because they found out to maintain the subscriptions. It's all about what's new. And so Netflix, if you produce for them a first season, if you want the second season, they usually bring it in house. And then they look and say, do they really need a third season? If they drop it, they won't lose any subscriptions, but something, quote, new will bring in new subscriptions.
It's just a different way of – it's just a different business model. I think the biggest problem filmmakers have and producers have is a lot of them are producing content based off of early 2000s, mid-90s information. That, like what we just talked about, is the new world. That is what the world is today. But I just talk to filmmakers, I'm sure you do too, and producers who still think that they're like, you know, there's still a DVD market. There's still like a monster, like the game has changed. And it seems to be changing now so rapidly. Like last year, this time, the game was, again, put COVID aside, it was still different. Like AVOD, I remember last year when you guys had, I think, your first AVOD panel, or one of the first AVOD panels up there, and like, you know, this AVOD thing's going to pick. And that was the key word. The year before that was OTT, was everyone was talking about. Before that was like SVOD. Like every year there's this new catchphrase. This year is obviously COVID.
Look, the technology, the pace of change is accelerating. COVID has accelerated that technology change. But when I look and I see that I've got an Alexa and I can ask Alexa, what time is it? This is like somebody driving a Model T Ford 100 years ago or saying, look at this radio, let's see if I can tune it and move the antenna. We're just at the very beginning. We think with our iPhones, we're all cool and stuff like this. And look what we can do. Literally, the iPhone's only 10 years old. Can you imagine 10 years after a car was invented? We're 1915, you know? And so we're at 1915 from a technology standpoint, from an entertainment standpoint. And what I'm really curious about is this. What new art forms are actually going to come forward? Motion pictures and art form came after the technology was developed. Records, long play records, 33 LP, only came forward. The art form, of making a 40-minute or 50-minute album, only came forward when you could get 40 or 50 minutes on a vinyl record. And so each of these televisions, same thing. The technology came first, and then artists determined how to use that technology to entertain us and then create business. And what I'm really curious about, here we are in 1920, not 2020, where is this technology taking us? What are these art forms that we can't even imagine today? We're seeing everybody struggle with the business side of change, but somewhere behind this, you know, it's too bad that Quibi didn't work, but I give them props for trying it, you know? What's that next art form? How are we going to entertain next?
By the way, where's all that content going? Like, they had full-blown shows. Like, someone's going to have to buy that, right?
All those 10-minute segments, put them back together, and they're going to have some films. Now, what I read, you probably did too, is they're out now peddling the content and seeing where it'll – and it's going to be piece by piece probably.
Yeah, I mean, because they have major stars and major shows that they had as far as Quibi. So, yeah, Quibi's a whole other conversation we can have. Yeah. It's a whole other thing. But, Jonathan, I want to thank you so much for being on the show. And I love talking to you. Every time we sit down and talk, it's great because you're a wealth of information. And for anybody who's interested in signing up for the AFM, the online, not virtual, the online AFM 2020, where do they go?
AmericanFilmMarket.com.
All right. Thank you. Thank you again, Jonathan, so much for being on the show. Thanks, my friend. I want to thank Jonathan for coming on the show and dropping the knowledge bombs that he did on the tribe today. Thank you so much, Jonathan. Now, if you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, head over to the show notes at filmtrepreneur.com/069. And guys, if you haven't already, please head over to filmbizpodcast.com. and leave a good review for the show. It really helps us out a lot. Thank you so much for listening. As always, be that filmtrepreneur. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Filmtrepreneur podcast at filmtrepreneur.com.